Hello everyone. From Glemon Partners from Nuveen, this is Glemon Insights. Here, we discuss all things about energy transition, from policy to technology. With assets in multiple geographies and nearly 4 billion euro asset under management, we are one of Europe's largest fund managers, focusing exclusively on investments in clean energy infrastructure. To find out more about us, visit www.glemon.com and don't forget the double N. Green hydrogen is produced starting from renewable sources, that's widely known, but how can we best achieve this, and which are the renewable technologies and scenarios that are best suited to produce hydrogen for the future of the planet? I am Manuel Gallio, Principal Asset Engineer at Glemon Partners from Nuveen, and I am very pleased today to be together again with my two lovely guests, Helena Anderson and Sandra Lees, who are respectively the founder of Ikigai and the Director of Legal at Vattenfall. If you recall, in the first part of this episode, we went through two interesting real case studies, and Helena, you were talking about the challenges encountered during the development phase of the Thames estuary that Ikigai is developing. Indeed, feasibility study and development is where most of the hydrogen projects currently are. So, Sandra, can you then tell us more about some of the issues that you have faced in developing the HT1 project in Vattenfall?
Yeah, for our HT1 project, actually, one of the outputs is to kind of map out the development and consenting processes for large-scale hydrogen production co-located with offshore wind farms, really to help speed up other development. We're using this as an R&D project pilot scale, so everything is taking a little bit longer. And yeah, as it's the first in the world, I mentioned that I know already, but I will keep mentioning it because we're super proud of it. It really does pose a challenge for everybody who's involved in the consenting and development side. As always, as Helena said, really it's the education, kind of communication and resourcing, which is super critical for us. We kind of expect those involved in the consenting process to automatically really have the knowledge and the resources available in order to determine whatever applications for consent comes forward. But at the moment, there's no framework in place to help the consenting process for these offshore hydrogen turbines. And I think it would be really useful for others if something like that was set up, really. Planning departments themselves probably would find it useful. I'm speaking on their behalf at the moment, obviously. And also then they will know when they can bring in other people like the health and safety executive. So that's kind of one element of it. Coupled with that is the public side, the local communities, and their kind of perception, really, of what hydrogen is. Understandably, whether there are any safety risks. Hydrogen isn't new. It's been around for a long, long time. It's just really this kind of green hydrogen that's a new part of it. So people have their homes generally fueled with gas. They run their cars, if not electric, they'll have a petrol or diesel car. So there's already an acceptance, really, of hazardous substances in people's neighbourhoods. So I think we can actually get to a position where there's going to be a similar public acceptance of hydrogen.
Of course, yeah, I think is the perception of the risk rather than the risk itself that has to be communicated. So have you been out with the local communities there to explain how this project can help them?
Yeah, a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, actually it must have been before Christmas now, a while ago, we held early stage public consultation event in Aberdeen itself, just to kind of launch the project to the local community. And actually identifying who the local stakeholders are is really important. So we contacted community councils because they play an important role in representing their local communities. We also put notices in newspapers, which maybe doesn't reach quite the same audience as it used to. So we went really quite old school, and we did a leaflet drop to all of the houses, in the local neighbourhood, inviting people to the consultation event, and also we created a website, which obviously is the way to reach out to people.
Did you get a good turnout?
Yeah, we did, actually. We got quite a few people coming. We've collated all of their responses now. And are going to then use that in further developing the project. A lot were locals who live really close by, looking at where we're going to bring the hydrogen to shore and what the impact is, mostly to do with safety and the actual the site of where it joins the shore, the landfall place, really.
May I go off piste slightly?
Yes, we go skiing.
But relevant.
We go skiing, Helena.
Yes, yeah. We are skiing friends, so this is why I'm using that phrasing. I'm interested as to whether or not the conversation with the local authority is about hydrogen per se. You know, you have nothing to worry about in terms of hydrogen production and distribution in the area, or hydrogen use within the domestic environment, hydrogen use in homes, yeah. Because that's obviously a very controversial statement. I have a view that if we care about fuel poverty, if we care about affordability, we have to be very careful talking about hydrogen being the replacement for natural gas as opposed to heat pumps or electrification of heat. Where is Vattenfall on all of that?
Yeah, we are not putting hydrogen in people's homes.
Right.
So what we are looking at only is the production of hydrogen, and then using other people will use that hydrogen for things like powering buses for other types of transportation, and not kind of putting it in houses. We're focusing a lot actually on low carbon heat networks, and that will be the source into people's houses rather than hydrogen.
So that I would say there's no such a thing as easy projects, but these challenges can come with the opportunities and upsides. In Glenmore, we already have an offshore wind farm portfolio, and the issue of low or even negative prices in some parts of Europe, especially the north of Europe, are already a reality. So, Sandra, how do you see the hydrogen production helping to resolve or even flip this from being a potential loss or to de-risk additional revenue stream?
It's a good point, actually. And I think the last 12 months, we've seen huge fluctuations in power prices. But I think if we can get to a position where forecasting is accurate enough to kind of predict demand for electricity and the prices we're going to receive for that, as also the demand for hydrogen, those operating co-located plants can then essentially choose whether they direct the energy to the grid or direct the energy to the electrolyzer. I can't even say that, electrolyzer. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I think that's going to be key, actually, is forecasting is the most important thing. There could then obviously be a curtailment where wind farms are required to shut down, and then they can direct all of their energy to the hydrogen production.
And then the long-term projections in certain areas with the grid restrictions in North Europe, they already project this from happening more and more often. Mm-hmm. So this is really a reality. It's unfortunately probably going to get worse. What about your view, Helena, on this topic?
Well, as you know, Manuel, we've been talking about that challenge in Germany, which is already, you know, the canary. Keep talking about coal mines, canary in the coal mine, in
we
the sense that
more green.
I do.
I need
to reform.
What's your homework?
But what Germany shows us is that if you're dealing with an offshore wind farm that has potentially curtailment of 50% at certain times, being able to monetize that curtailment through the production of hydrogen is potentially a project-saving activity. But I think the challenge that we have is recognizing how we reduce the marginal cost of hydrogen production. And a huge part of that is not just the input cost of the power in the case of electrolysis or waste in the context of bioenergy to hydrogen. Let's not forget there are two pathways there. But it's also the efficiency of the electrolyzer, both per se in terms of the technology, but how the duration of its, if it's running, of its cycles. So the challenge we have in other markets where the curtailment is either more difficult to forecast or is only for shorter periods during the day, if your aim is to try and run that electrolyzer 22 hours a day in order to maximize its efficiency, a curtailment scenario is not of itself going to justify economically their production. So I think it will very much depend on the transactional circumstances as to whether or not hydrogen is an optimal way to resolve the issue. But we absolutely have to look to it, because in terms of scaling hydrogen production, green hydrogen production, clearly offshore wind with its low levelized cost of energy and therefore the power input itself is a lower cost, it must be part of the solution, whether that's in the UK in terms of offshore wind or really large solar and wind in other jurisdictions where that's the optimal source of green generation.
Well, we're clearly talking about large offshore wind farms with the production of hydrogen at scale, but making a step back, is big necessarily good or needed for hydrogen?
Yeah, very, very good. Well, of course you would say that.
So we have two different views here. I'm really looking forward to hearing from both of you.
Well, I will put the case for small is beautiful then. At the beginning of the industry, if I look at it from an institutional investor perspective, I'm very worried about route to market. If I am looking for something that reflects the sorts of structures that I've got used to in renewable energy, you know, 15-year contracts, minimizing the amount of merchant risk in the deal, then the idea that you have, as my co-founder Roberto Lessa, merchant risk on crack when it comes to hydrogen, because you not only do you not necessarily know whether or not there's the market there or at what price, but you don't actually literally have the infrastructure necessarily to get the hydrogen to market. So in the early stages of the development of this sector, the matching of supply and demand, which might mean smaller scale projects initially, maybe a pipeline, a portfolio of those projects of, say, 10 megawatts scale electrolyzers, will be the way in which we can minimize that route to market risk, minimize that merchant risk. We can also put in place structures whereby that position changes over time. So as the demand is coming forward, maybe you do a shorter term deal with one of the big distributors in the market that you know can place the hydrogen. And you do that for a relatively short term period because you're minimizing your credit risk and you know that there's a transport demand for hydrogen, for example. But maybe that the role of that structure dissipates as locational demand comes forward. So we've got a project in the estuary, which is a maritime hydrogen project. Initially, you're producing for the haulage market, for example, maybe going through one of the big distributors. But that's only as the ships convert, vessels on the river convert to hydrogen or dual fuel. And by that stage, you want to switch across to contracted revenues with those operators on a diversified basis. But you're always looking constantly at how you're matching the supply and demand through the process in order to meet institutional investor requirements.
But are you only talking about green hydrogen or are you talking about grey and blue as well?
Well, in that context, I am talking about green, you're right. I am talking about solar and wind as the sources of production. If you are looking at blue, then obviously you're looking at a very different scale. And, you know, those utilities that are focused on gas to hydrogen, you know, they're producing at an enormous scale and they are a transitional solution potentially for some industry to be able to access hydrogen.
But surely then that one of the issues that green hydrogen face is the cost of production in comparison to grey hydrogen. Only way to bring the cost down is economies of scale, and therefore big is beautiful.
Over time, but you'll never get those projects built now because nobody will put their money into a project where they don't know whether they have any offtake.
Yeah, you're right. But I think in order to actually build an industry for green hydrogen, we have to have fiscal intervention from the government, because to compare the price of green hydrogen to grey hydrogen or even blue, actually, it's so much higher. And if we want to get into a position of having fully renewable source of hydrogen, it's the only way to do it. I mean, industry's ESG agendas, I think, are going to help as well. But yeah, it's going to...
I'm not sure that big necessarily requires or is the prerequisite to being able to deliver low input costs for the electricity. If you look at the price of private wire solar, and the private wire piece is the key bit here, private wire solar, private wire wind, the costs of that have come down enormously.
Come down, but at the moment, they
actually, offshore wind can't do private wire. So you're paying the distribution transmission charges, which actually makes the hydrogen that you're producing out of the market. I can produce hydrogen from a co-located solar plant much more cheaply than I can do it from a very large offshore wind plant at this point in time.
I think that it's also the case of analyzing the characteristic of each project. project by project specifics.
Absolutely.
Because there may be situations where a small PV plant located in the middle of nowhere is going to have issues to find a route to market of hydrogen. But some other small ones can be located nearby, a chemical facility.
Where, or an airport.
Or an airport. But the economy of scale and the number of offshore wind farms that will be built, especially in the north of Europe, will increase massively in the next years, given how many projects are under development now. And hopefully that scale will take the prices down and probably encourage that demand or help to create that demand that you were talking about before.
The thing is, we have to walk and chew gum at the same time. We've got to be doing what Sandra's saying while developing the regulation and the markets and the understanding of how to integrate systems and deliver it to retail consumers. We've got to be able to do that while we are scaling up the industry.
Let's try to do that. I think we have a few opportunities also in Glenmont. One question for you, Sandra, regarding the market. Then how would you like then to see the market develop in the next years to help these projects?
So with a clean sheet of paper, I would like to map out actually a coordinated hydrogen infrastructure. So that, as Helena said at the beginning, actually each developer then doesn't have to think about the production of hydrogen, transportation, the storage, the distribution, everything. So I think by having some sort of coordinated infrastructure in place actually is going to help in market confidence. And that in turn will help increase the demand for hydrogen. As we all know, it's demand that creates the market.
Absolutely. Helena, one last question for you then. We're talking about investing in hydrogen production, but what about investors focusing on industrial application of use of hydrogen?
Yeah, I get this question a lot from institutional investors, and it's an important thing to recognise the way in which government support is coming through is fragmented between industrial applications, which is being supported by, in the UK, the what they call the hydrogen business model, which is for those who are familiar with contracts for difference in the offshore wind sector, they're seeking to replicate something similar for hydrogen. And that is distinct from a support scheme or a market, really, that was created by the UK government, the Department for Transport in this case, in 2010, many years ago, the Renewable Transport Fuel Obligation. So there's already a mechanic in place to create a price support, if you like, very similar to the renewable obligation for the ROCs scheme that they're all familiar with, but for renewable transport fuels. So that means that there's already a mechanism in place for revenue support if you're applying hydrogen in any kind of transport application, really. There are some limited exceptions, but broadly speaking, it covers aviation, it now covers maritime, it covers non-mobile construction uses, it certainly covers road haulage. And so what sits behind your question, I think, is that a lot of investors are very excited about the hydrogen business model coming, the CFD coming in, because it will enable scale. And the challenge, though, with the contract for difference scheme is it's competitive and it requires a huge amount of work in order to be able to bid within that competition, as Sandra knows probably better than most people in the whole market. And so you have a tension there between the smaller projects that we've been talking about that lead the industry and the way in which the regulatory support works. And so when you're talking about very large industrial consumers, so 20, 30 tons a day of hydrogen, and therefore hundreds of megawatts of electrolyzer capacity, for example, then the CFD makes a lot of sense. A lot of investors are concerned about the time frame for its implementation, though. And so for those investors, I would say, if you want to be in hydrogen, look to those projects that can be supported by transport support and other grants that are going on in the industry, and dip your toe in the water of those now in advance of the hydrogen business model coming through. And we are talking about the UK, but there are similar schemes in Italy, in Germany, It's a model, this sort of a certificate trading scheme is a model that is being applied in transport applications of renewable fuels all over Europe.
Well, let's hope that investors do hear this and take this suggestion seriously, because I think the potentiality of the hydrogen uses and production are very large. And in the next years, hopefully, the incentive schemes, whatever name they can get, they will support this development as they did for PV and wind in the past years. However, the main difference is that the market for the product, which was electricity, was already there. The market for hydrogen here needs to be created. That is the main difference. So thank you very much to both of you. We came to the end of today's episode of Glemons Insights. We hope you have enjoyed it, and be sure to follow us and to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. A big thank you to our guests, Helena and Sandra, for joining us today, and thank you for listening. Until next time.
Ciao.
Ciao.
Ciao.